No, the first question is not really a question. It's now I know why we're called retreat ants. I don't know why you call yourself ants, but anyway, sometimes we call you yogis. Over in Indonesia, where I just returned, the book Opening the Door of Your Heart, you know, it's got a different title over in the United States, Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung. In the German edition, it's called The Cow That Cried, Die Kuh der Weinte. And in Indonesia, they decided to give it the name of, in Bahasa, The Worm in the Pile of Dung. So The Worm is the title of the book. And so when I was in Indonesia, all the yogis on a two-day retreat, they called themselves little worms. So sometimes you call yourself yogis, sometimes chaching, which is Bahasa for worm. Or you can call yourself retreat ants if you like. Because the job is to take you out of the pile of dung, like in that story. So retreat ants, I don't know why you call yourself retreat ants. But anyway, there we go. Okay, next question. I tried meditating, but ended up sleeping most of the day. I know I shouldn't judge, but can't help but see today as lazy. No, don't call it lazy. Call it compassionate. You can look at anything in life two ways. Just after the tea, I went to Bodhinyana Monastery just to stay with the monks, to make sure everything's okay over there and have my shower. And just one of the monks was going to teach up in the prison. And he paid respect to me. He came back 5 minutes later because he left his bag. And he said, oh, I wasn't mindful. I said, no, you shouldn't look at it like that. You just weren't attached. So you can look at anything one of two ways. You can say, oh, he lost his mindfulness because he didn't pick up his bag. Or you could look at it, he was a monk who had so few attachments, he didn't care about his bag, he didn't keep thinking about it. So I say, well done, you showed your lack of attachment to your bag, so you forgot where it was. So anything in life you can see one of two ways. And so you say it's lazy. No, you're compassionate. How do I tell the difference between lazy or giving into the body? Also, if mind is separate from body, shouldn't mindfulness overcome tiredness? I know letting be works, but this particular part is still unclear why it works. Next time I feel tired, how do I know whether to do walking meditation or allow to fall asleep? It's usually most people in our modern world that we are just so control freaks. We've been taught for a long time to actually exploit our body, to force our body to go to work. And you know, why? Just in Singapore, somebody asked me, is it the same in Australia that so many people get cancer? Because the cancer wards in Singapore are full. And it's quite clear to me just why people get so many cancers these days. It's just because of the way they treat their bodies. You know, we just exploit our bodies and we just force our bodies. We just don't give it any rest. So, it's not that you're being lazy. Somehow that in our tradition, our Western tradition, we think that if you're lazy, that's somehow bad. If you care for your body, you're just being sort of indulgent. And so because of that, because we don't care for our body, many people sort of get very tense and they get all these sicknesses and they die young. You know, the oldest man in the world right now, according to the Guinness Book of Records, is an old monk, a Thai Theravada monk in Phuket. He's 115 years of age. Now the oldest man in the world officially, according to Guinness Book of Records. So there you go, it proves the point. He's a forest monk. So, you know, just relax. And then you live long. And he's pretty healthy as well. So, if you feel tired, go and take a rest. If you don't need to sleep, you're laid back on your bed there and you won't fall asleep at all. The very fact that whoever wrote this slept all day was the body was saying thank you to you. We're actually catching up on much of your sleep. Number one, it will make you much healthier. You relax the body and give the body a time to heal and take away a lot of that tension. Look how you live your day. And you have to wake up with an alarm because it's not a natural waking up. You have to get up early to go and do this and go and do that. You're rushing around all the day. And at night time, sometimes we don't go to bed until late. Because of that, we're just so tense. And if you're mindful enough, you can actually feel that tension in your body. So you just relax for the first couple of days and use that mindfulness to know what your body feels like. And you realize that those one or two days of relaxing, sleeping if you wish, you feel the effect on your body, and it's a wonderful effect. You feel sort of tightnesses in the body, blockages being relieved. The whole body relaxes. And once that body relaxes, it's far, far easier for your mind to relax. If you end up sleeping for 9 days, for the whole retreat, then that's going a bit too far. But for the first 2 or 3 days, just indulge in just resting the body. So for the first 2 or 3 days, if you feel like sleeping, go to sleep. And don't set the time. When you wake up, you wake up. And then you can usually have a cup of tea or have a shower and then come and meditate. And you feel relaxed. The body wants to work with you. Because, again, the way you were brought up, always forcing the body, it was called discipline. But that discipline was just control. It wasn't working with things, it was trying to control things. And the whole of our Western civilization is just being totally unnatural, trying to control things rather than working with things. So here you get back to a much more natural routine. And we tried this many, many times. And you find, by resting in the first part of this retreat, you'll do far more meditation in the latter half of the retreat. For most people, generally speaking, you sleep more in the beginning. You get back to your average in the middle, and you find you sleep far less in the latter part of the retreat. Not because you're forcing yourself, because it's natural. The body doesn't need any sleep, it's caught up. So for the first 2 or 3 days, give your body the benefit of the doubt. If it says, I want to sleep, sleep. In the middle part of the retreat, be a bit more questioning of whether the body really needs to sleep or not. At the last part of the retreat, if it says, oh, I really need to go to sleep, only if you're really convinced you're tired, then go to sleep. And he said, if the mind is separate from the body, shouldn't mindfulness overcome tiredness? Your mind is connected to the body. You know, it's influenced by the body. And so because of that, you will find that if the body is relaxed, the mind can meditate very easily. But more than that, it is because the way you treat the body, the same attitude will be the same attitude you treat everything else with your mind. It's a mental attitude which is important. And if it's a mental attitude of forcing and controlling and telling your body, this is, you're tired, I don't care, you're going to meditate, that degree of harshness and control and regarding everything in your life as a slave to bend to your will, that attitude is what is very dangerous in meditation. That's what stops peace and stillness happening. So in a sense, the mind is separate from the body but influenced by the body. But the same mental attitude which says, I need to rest now, is the same mental attitude of kindness which will look at the meditation and say, I'll just let the mind be dull right now. I'll just let the mind just be restlessness right now. I'll just leave it alone. If that's what it wants to do, that's what it can do. And you find that degree of compassion, that degree of letting be, is actually the cause of stillness. There's something which I called like meditation karma. Just like we have karma in many other parts of our life, there's this particular type of karma which affects our meditation. Good meditation karma and bad meditation karma. So good meditation karma leads to good meditation results, peace, stillness, strong mindfulness. Bad meditation karma leads to the opposite. You know, just frustration, boredom, tension, just struggle. That's the result of bad meditation karma. And I mentioned this morning what good meditation karma is. making peace, being kind, being gentle, being patient. Those are the three right intentions of the Eightfold Path, plus patience. And that's good intention, good karma. It has to lead to good results. Bad meditation karma is craving. I want, I want, I want. It's ill will. You know, mind, you're going to do what I tell you to. You're going to sort of, I don't care. I just hate sleepiness. I hate laziness. That degree of ill will is bad meditation karma. And also aggression, forcing the mind, is bad meditation karma. And impatience as well. So there is a thing called good meditation karma and bad meditation karma. And the reason I bring that up is because it shows by making good meditation karma, you are creating the seeds, the causes for peace and stillness, for the deep meditations to occur. And that's all you can ever do, create the causes, put all the conditions in place, and then wait for those conditions to ripen. You cannot do more than that. So by making peace, being kind, being gentle, you're doing the maximum you possibly can do to create deep meditation, stillness, insights, and enlightenment. So that just is our job. So that attitude is the most important thing to encourage. And if you have that attitude towards your body, just make peace, be kind, be gentle with it, then you know it needs to sleep. You're not being lazy, you're just making peace, being kind, being gentle with your body. And that attitude will flow over to how you treat your mind. And then you're not being lazy, you're actually developing good meditation karma. Sure, when you're in bed asleep, you don't get jhanas. But your attitude is creating the causes and conditions for jhana in the future. And that's happened. I keep telling this story every retreat. But in interviews, people come, you know, third, fourth, fifth day of the retreat, and they get so frustrated, they're getting nowhere. And they're getting so tense, they feel they want to leave and go home. They're getting a waste of time. And then I tell them, go to your room, lay down and have a sleep. I can't, that's lazy. Go to your room, lay down and have a sleep. No, that's indulgent. Go to your room, lay down and have a sleep. And a shower afterwards and a cup of tea. And they do that. And they come the next possible interview time and say, Ajahn Brahm, it worked, it worked. Of course it works. I don't know how many times I've done that and 100% success rate. They get one of their best meditations after they relax. Because all that frustration, all that tension, you're trying too hard. So just learning how to let go a little bit is a wonderful thing. So if you really need to, have a rest. First 2 or 3 days, it will work. So next time I feel tired, how do I know whether to do walking meditation or allow to fall asleep? First 2 or 3 days, next time you feel tired, go to your room. Is there any comments on that? Because it's an important point. It does work. I've been teaching a long time now. Dear Ajahn, this is not a question. I just thought I would point out that it was the king of Rohan, not the king of Gondor, who Grima Wormtongue is trying to control. Apart from this minor detail, I thoroughly enjoyed your talk. There we go. King of Rohan, not the king of Gondor. Anyway, that's close enough. No one is perfect. Can you please talk about method of walking meditation? Do we have to do labeling? I do self-talk for every single step at all times. One of the great advantages of doing walking meditation is you don't get anywhere. You start at one end, a few minutes later you're back where you started again. That's brilliant! So it just tells you that meditation is not about getting anywhere. You just go round and round anyway. So number one, remember, meditation is not going anywhere. It's just going to the end and coming right back again and ending up where you started off. So it's not sort of getting anywhere. It's actually how you travel is important. So not the destination, but the path, the journey, the method. So as you do walking meditation, especially if your body gets a bit sort of tired and achy, a bit of walking meditation just loosens up the muscles, gets rid of the aches and pains. And that's why we have these three meditation, walking meditation rooms designed here. You got the red mats because we always think that, you know, we really respect you yogis, so we decided to give you red carpet treatment for your walking meditation. So if you want to walk on the red carpet, now you have a chance of walking backwards and forwards on the red carpet of Jhana Grove Retreat Center. And we try to make it just the right type of softness, not too soft, not too hard. And I think pretty much succeeded. So you walk from one end to the other and then back again. And by putting the red carpets there, we're trying to use psychology to make sure you walk on the carpets rather than in between them, or rather diagonally. Because there's always some people like to walk long. So before there'd be one person who just walked diagonally backwards and forwards, which meant no one else could use that meditation room. So this is actually corralling you into certain paths. If you don't want to walk in these little rooms, there's so many other places in this complex where you can do walking meditation. But you start, collect all of your senses, and say the first stage of meditation, walking meditation, just be present moment awareness. So you're not trying to do anything, you're not trying to go anywhere, you're just walking. Just be in the present moment. If you're in the future, it's where you're going. If you're sort of in the past, it's where you've come from. In walking meditation, you just got to be where you are. Not particularly achieving anywhere or getting anywhere, just walking. And you don't have to walk slowly. You can walk fast, you can walk in the middle. Just walk naturally, just how the body wants to walk. Usually we put our attention 2 meters in front of us. You know, and with the gaze down, not looking to the left or looking to the right. The reason you do that 2 meters in front of you is so you can see any obstacles on the path, so you don't sort of step on things you shouldn't step on or trip over. Obviously, in these rooms, there's no obstacles at all. But, you know, putting your attention 2 meters in front of you, it just gives you that sense of safety that you know where you're going. If you try closing your eyes while you're doing walking meditation, you get tense out of fear because you don't know what's going to happen in front of you. So keep your eyes open, 2 meters in front, and just walk naturally. Present moment awareness. And your job is just to let go and let the body do the walking. But not to go fantasizing and thinking and just dreaming and planning. So present moment awareness. Then see if you can be silent. So the inner commentary stops. Once you have those first 2 degrees of stillness pretty much in hand, then you can start to feel the movement of your feet. And just first of all, you just know left foot moving or right foot moving. But the more still you get, the stronger your mindfulness becomes. You literally see much more of what's going on. So it's no longer just lifting. It's no longer just moving forward, left foot, right foot. You see all the different sensations which are involved in one step. And it's fascinating just how much goes on in the foot once your mindfulness gets strong. And then it sort of becomes quite fascinating. Yeah, you can do left, right, you can do lifting, moving forward, touching. You can do that to begin with. But after a while, that's just like a crutch. You let it go. You don't need to give it these things names. There's so much going on, it's so interesting. But after a while you get very cool and very, very involved in just all the movement of the feet. And then quite naturally, usually that's the time you walk slowly. It's not because you force yourself to walk slowly, it just happens naturally. So be natural. I told people that at a conference in Vietnam a few years ago, there were some of Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh's disciples. And because it was a conference, we had like what they usually call these days breakout sessions, you know, small workshops. And every workshop had a moderator, and the moderator was there to take notes and then take those notes back and report back to the plenary session. And there's about 8 workshops or 8 breakout sessions. And so there's 8 moderators, and each one had about 5 minutes each to sum up the conclusions of their discussions or some interesting points which happened. Just a summary so everyone else who wasn't at that workshop could actually hear. It's only 5 minutes. And when one of these moderators, who was disciple of Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, when it was her turn, they said, "Now would you please go to the microphone and tell the audience about the conclusions of your session." But then she started doing the slow walking. She very, very mindfully sat up, very mindfully turned around. And as she lifted the foot and moved the foot forward and dropped the foot onto the ground, she was so mindful. It took her 4 minutes to get to the microphone. And it was only 1 minute to give her presentation. So the big moderator said, "Hurry up, you only got 5 minutes each. You spent 4 minutes just getting to the blooming microphone." And that was a case of like walking meditation done wrongly. That was the time to do fast walking meditation. Being mindful of all the audience there. So it's nice to do walking meditation, but keep it natural. And then you can find you get very, very peaceful and very, very still. If your mind goes wandering all over the place, there is a Thai form of walking meditation using a mantra, which I really encourage you to do. Especially if it's a bit of fun, but it also has a great effect if you persist with it. And that is using the mantra, as your left foot moves forward, you recite to yourself, "I will die." The right foot goes forward, "That's for sure. I will die, that's for sure." For the Thai people here, it's called die, nair, die, nair, die, nair, die, nair. So I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And of course, it's funny at first. It's a weird thing to do. But then, "I will die, that's for sure." You keep repeating it to yourself with each movement of the feet. Actually, that's true, isn't it? I will die, that's for sure. And most people come across fear, in real fear, because it's something which is very true. It's not a joke. And then eventually you get past that fear. "I will die, that's for sure." So all the things you worry about, all the concerns which you have, which occupy your mind, they get put in this wonderful perspective. They don't matter at all. All your relations, all your money problems, all your health problems, all the things which we concern about, which we fill our minds with, has no point at all when we know, "I will die, that's for sure." And you get incredibly peaceful as your attachments just drop away. Unfortunately, it's only temporary, but still a very nice time. Just imagining you're dead, with no attachments, no problems, no debts. Ah, so free. So that's another way to do walking meditation, the "I will die, that's for sure" method. But please don't die until after the retreat, because it's very inconvenient for Bianca to arrange funeral parlour. "Dear Venerable Ajahn, could you talk on how to use the awareness of the absence of things to support stillness? Does the absence of things relate to a peaceful, kind, gentle and patient?" Yeah, because this is, I gave a sutta reading on the smaller sutta on emptiness, Nodamara, a couple of weeks ago. And it is a beautiful thing, because sometimes people get bored when they do meditation. You know, they're still and they're peaceful, but so what? One of the great perceptions is almost like a perception of gratitude. Especially gratitude for what you are missing. Later on this week, maybe Tuesday morning, I will say, for those of you who are getting bored, think where you might be if you weren't on this retreat. You'd be in your car going to work. You'd be facing the boss, sitting in front of this stupid computer. You'd be at work. But now, you're free. You have the whole day free. And that really gives you appreciation for like being here when you realize what you're missing, what's left. So the perception of what's missing is a very beautiful, encouraging perception. So when you're here, you're free of your husband. Oh, wonderful. I don't have to sort of look after him or care for him or wash up or cook for him during this retreat. I'm free of my wife. Knack, 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 knack. I'm free of my kids. So when you remember what you're free of, it gives you this wonderful sense of peace. It's like appreciating simplicity. And as you go deep in the meditation, when you get present moment awareness, you're free of all this past and future, which is so worrisome. All the past with all the terrible things which happened to you, all the unfair things and all the bad things you have done yourself, all the guilt and the anger and the grief, it's all gone. Oh, what a relief. And for the future, all your concerns and plans and worries and fears, they're missing in the present moment. So when you get into the present moment, realize this is empty of anger and guilt. It's empty of fear and worry. And that gives you a wonderful sense of appreciation, which helps you remain in the present moment. Silence. Ah, you're free of this terrible noise between your ears. This thinking mind which sometimes never stops. This mind which promises to give you wisdom, but usually just gives you headache. This thinking mind which goes on and on and on, never really getting anywhere. Now you're free of that. Peace, stillness, oh, bliss. So when the mind is still, notice what it's free of. When you get onto the breath, you're free of all the other parts of the body. This body is a pain. There's always somewhere which is either itchy, my nose is itchy, my throat is itchy, my legs are achy. I don't know what's wrong with you, your guts may be aching. I don't think there's anybody in this room who hasn't got something which is aching or irritating in your body. But when you get into into the breath, all of that disappears. You're free from this very demanding, irritating body. And you remember that, so when you get into the breath, oh, it's wonderful, I don't have to scratch anymore. When I was in Thailand, and all these mosquitoes. Actually, when I was in Malaysia, I gave a talk at the Thai temple, the Jetavana Monastery in Petaling Jaya. And they were telling me in the meditation room, in the upper story, they'd done some very fine artwork to make it look like a forest, to give it some atmosphere for meditation retreats. You know, like trees made out of concrete, but no leaves on it. And they even had sort of like sounds of like, you know, forest sounds as I went in, some sort of CD they put in somewhere to try and give it atmosphere as it was in a forest. And I told them the one thing which was missing was the mosquitoes. If you'd have got some mosquitoes in there, it would be like a real forest. No, they just wanted just the trees and the sounds, but not the real thing. But those mosquitoes, they taught me how to meditate. Because, know the story, it's hard for me to tell new stories when each one of you have been coming to these retreats for the last 26 years. So, if I repeat the story, it's just because you keep on coming. What do you expect? But in that time, there were so many mosquitoes, and Ajahn Chah had the idea in the first few months of Wat Bananachat, had the idea of having all the monks doing the evening chanting under the trees with the villagers. He'd give a talk and we'd meditate. I think meditate and then we'd give a talk. And the meditation would always be just at dusk, at the very time the mosquitoes came out, when they were at their peak. And those mosquitoes drove you crazy. Now there were 60 or 70 on you at a time. We counted them, heaps of them. And it was incredibly hard to bear. And there was no mosquito repellent. There was no sort of mosquito coils. So you just had to take it. And every now and again, I'd open my eyes and see all the Thai monks sitting still. I never realized afterwards, the mosquitoes never went for the Thai monks. They went for the Westerners. And one of the reasons was, it wasn't just, you know, the old joke of looking for Western food. It was a very, it was actually physical, that the, because we came from a cold climate, sort of our veins were actually closer to the skin, you know, so that we could lose heat. But for the Asians, your blood vessels are actually a little bit deeper down. So actually, we are actually hotter. As far as the mosquitoes are concerned, we are actually easier to find. So that's why you put a Westerner and an Asian, and a mosquito will 9 times out of 10 go for the Westerner. So, you know, I thought the Thais were tough, but they weren't. They weren't being bitten. The Westerners were being bitten. We were getting all. So Ajahn Chah wasn't a tough guy. He didn't realize just the mosquitoes weren't for us. And it was very tough, but the only thing which I could do was actually to watch my breath. You had to watch your breath so you wouldn't sort of watch any other part of your body until you were totally focused on your breath. Breathing in, breathing out, and the whole rest of the body had totally disappeared. You couldn't feel any mosquito at all. And you know, I had to do that because the alternative was being aware of my body, and that was just so irritating. So it taught me just how to focus on one thing. So you focus on the body and you couldn't feel anything. And that was actually how I coped. So I thank those mosquitoes for teaching me just how to watch my breath. You couldn't wander. One little moment of wandering and you feel your arm again or your head. So you focus on the breath, breath in, breath out, breath in, breath out. You didn't move from the breath. So that one actually really helped me to do that. So for me, the absence of the body was the absence of the mosquitoes, and that was bliss. So it's wonderful to do the idea of absence. So when you're meditating, it's not what's there, but what's missing. And that gives you a great sense of peace and fulfillment. At the very least, you know, you're free of all that housework, you're free of the TV, you're free of the mobile phone. In this area here, your phone doesn't get a signal. There are areas where you can go to get a signal, and some of you know those areas, but don't cheat. For 9 days, be free. So that means that after a while you find the world doesn't go wrong without you. Now your whole business or your family doesn't sort of suffer because you don't answer the mobile phone. You're not that important. You're not Barack Obama. If he was on retreat, I'd let him use his mobile phone. But that way that we can just let go. So we're free of all these things. So actually we're on retreat, we're on a holiday. And the other thing you're free of schedules and control. So we have to have lunch at a certain time and breakfast, but it's pretty flexible. You know, you can go a bit late and you sort of still get something to eat. But I want you to be free of time. Because in our Western world, it always schedules, always running around to meet the next appointment. So see if you can just lessen that as much as possible. Because that causes so much stress in life, always having time. So that's why if anybody asks me the time, I always say it's 9 minutes past now, on the ninth day of the ninth month, 2000 and now. So just get into the present moment. Okay, Ajahn Brahma, I sometimes get this urge to laugh out loud during meditation. Why now should I handle this in the retreat? I just laugh, cheer everyone else up. Because sometimes people are so miserable on retreat. So some, actually not on these retreats, they're usually pretty good. People have got a peaceful demeanor, at least, you know, so far, people are pretty peaceful. But I've been on some retreats, and if you were sitting up here as a teacher, it would be frightening to open your eyes. You know, the way that some people are struggling in pain. But this retreat, people are pretty relaxed, which I'm very proud of. But if you wish to laugh out loud, it just means that, you know, you're just letting go of things and you feel happy, uplifted. Remember, laughter is a sign of a light-hearted mind. So depressed people, angry people, they just can't laugh at all. You tell them a funny joke and say, I've heard that before. Doesn't matter if you've heard it before, it's funny, laugh. So that way that we can sort of have that laughter and just have that lightness. And look, Ajahn Chah would often be laughing. He was a very funny monk. And apparently Ajahn Mun, his teacher, was always laughing. And that is why, that, you know, when you become enlightened, you know what an enlightened person is called? He's called a ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-rahat. Not quite true, but they're sort of very light-hearted. Dear Ajahn, what is the significance of the Buddha Rupa inside the stupa? Okay, if you've looked at our stupas over here, inside is a Buddha statue, and that they come from the central Java, from the great stupa at Borobudur. It's an almost exact replica, only it is 108% bigger. When it was being made, they told me that Ajahn Sumedho in England had a stupa which was 110% bigger. And out of respect for him, I decided I'd go a tiny bit smaller. But 108 is a very good number, so I did 108%. And it's a replica, the same type of stone, which was given as a gift to Jhana Grove by some devotees in Indonesia, which is very wonderful of them. But if you go into those, the Borobudur in central Java, you will see again, inside every one of these little stupas is a Buddha statue. And I was told the meaning is this. If you get on top of the platform and you put your hand inside, if you can touch the Buddha statue, it means you will find true love. That's what they said. So I don't want to see any of you trying that. Especially those of you who are married. But that was a tradition. That was obviously just the people just thinking about that. But all it really was is having a beautiful Buddha statue so people could look at it, but still have the stupa shape. Because a stupa is supposed to be a reliquary, a place where the remains of Buddhas or enlightened beings are kept for posterity. And these are a type of stupa where you can actually see what's inside. But instead of some old bones, you see this beautiful Buddha statue. And sometimes this relic business is really getting over the top in many parts of the world. You've got so many relics here and so many relics there. Even just a few days ago, we moved the relics from the old Buddhist fellowship in Singapore quarters to a new one. But even then, I told a few people what the real relics of the Buddha are. The real relics of the Buddha are not bits of bone. The real relics of the Buddha is the Dhamma, is the teaching. Yeah? That's the relic of the Buddha. So instead of worshipping bits of bone, worship the teachings. In other words, how the Buddha taught, what he said, practice and follow. Then you're worshipping the real relics of the Buddha. Because there is a sutta called the Dhammadayata Sutta. It's the being heirs to the Dhamma, where the Buddha said, monks, nuns, disciples, don't be heir to my material things, be heirs to the Dhamma. Because as a teacher, as almost like a father of the Sangha, the Buddha would not give you any money to his children or to his daughters, but would leave you the greatest inheritance of all, the Dhamma. So be an heir to the Dhamma. That's the real relics of the Buddha, the teachings. Because, yeah, you can have relics, but look, in many countries, you know, this is recorded history, they took those relics into war. They put them on top of their banners as they went in to fight the enemy. And that's just disgusting. When you understand what Buddhism is all about. So the relics can be abused. These are the material relics. But the Dhamma, the teachings, that can never be abused. So that's the real relics of the Buddha. So it's actually quite a wise thing for whoever built that great stupa at Borobudur, not to put sort of pieces of bone, but put a Buddha statue. Because that's much closer to the teachings of Buddha. Because it encapsulates, you know, peace, compassion, and virtue, stillness and compassion. As I tell many people these days, when I bow down to a Buddha statue, I bow down to what it represents, which to me is virtue, That's my first bow. Peace or stillness, second bow. Wisdom or compassion, the third bow. Because that's what I worship. That's what it stands for. That's what it represents for me. Virtue, peace and compassion. Sila, samadhi, panya. So when I worship a Buddha, I'm not worshipping just the statue, I'm worshipping what it stands for. And when you go to a place like Indonesia, and many Muslims came to my talks, and you say, that's what we're doing. We're bowing not to an idol, not to an image, we're bowing down to virtue, peace and compassion. I think, oh, why didn't someone tell us that before? No, we wouldn't be so upset about you bowing to this and bowing to that. So that's what we actually do. So inside those stupas is a symbol for virtue, a symbol of peace, a symbol of wisdom and compassion, a Buddha statue. So it's a real relic of the Buddha enshrined in that stupa. That makes sense? Very good. Ah, amazing. I very much enjoyed the sutta on voidness. I would love to hear more of the same if you can manage to incorporate the topic in one of your talks. That must have really made an effect, because that's the second question, just out of even a few questions on the voidness, on emptiness. Because this is also a point that when you get to a certain stage in meditation, the breath disappears, there's nothing left before the nimitta comes out. You say, what should I watch? And it's a very good way of watching and say, notice what's missing. The breath is missing, the body is missing. That becomes your object of meditation. Not what's there, but what's missing. So just a different way of looking, that's all. As one of our monks who was an actor told me, he said there was a method of acting which he found very useful for his meditation, where the actors were taught not to notice the things on stage, you know, the people, but what was actually between the people, the space between people. So just in this room, you don't just notice the people or the walls or the Buddha statue or the cushions on the floor. You notice what's between everybody. It's a different way of looking. And he said that gave you a sense of relationship on the stage, so you could actually interact, you know, with the props and the people in a much more fascinating an enjoyable way. And it's the same with meditation. The space between people is what's missing in this room. It's the emptiness in this room. If you can do that in meditation, you do start to see the spaces between the thoughts, the emptiness which surrounds every thought. You notice what's missing. And that gives you a great sense of peace and stillness. And you realize, yes, you are getting somewhere in the meditation, because things are falling away and disappearing. Very good. And anyone who stays up past 9 o'clock this evening will soon see the emptiness in this hall as everyone goes back to bed. For the benefit of the other meditators, please explain how to meditate when in much pain. How does one concentrate into the source of the pain? With deep respect to the Sangha. If you're in very, very great pain, then just go take Panadol or aspirin or something. First of all, be kind to the body, because being aware of pain and being with pain is a very tough meditation object. So we usually have to learn on the easy subjects first of all before we go into the tough ones. So if you can avoid pain, please avoid it. This is why we have those seats in the back. Again, when we design this meditation, our center, we try to find chairs which were suited not just for sitting on, but for meditating on. So those chairs were designed specifically. I think the legs were shortened so you can have your feet flat on the floor for most people. You had the armrests there were for stop you falling off when you get sleepy. We actually thought of putting a seatbelt on there for those who've got really, really sleepy. But and they're upholstered, and we tried out a number of chairs, and those were the ones we thought were the most comfortable to meditate on. And I think people have told me they are actually very comfortable for meditation. they've got the right lumbar support or whatever else it's called. So that if your body is stiff and achy, get on one of the chairs and meditate on the chairs so you don't have to experience too much pain. So if it's a pain which you can do something about by moving, by sitting in a different position, then please take that strategy first of all. But it is true that sometimes, even on a retreat, there are some pains which just will not go away. Whether you sit on a chair or sit on the ground, or even if you lay down on your bed, it's still painful. And sometimes you even take an aspirin or something and it's still there. Such pains, then one way of overcoming them, and I've been mentioning this in Nolamara, is put your mindfulness in the center of it, which is a tough thing to do, and then do relaxation with compassion from the middle of that pain. Because at the very least, you'll be relaxing a few of the muscles which scrunch up and contract, which cause some of the feeling of pain. You'll be relaxing things. Because some pain is an overreaction of the body to some sort of infection or some wound. And by relaxing, you're overcoming that overreaction. I know because I suffer from hay fever and some allergies sometimes. All of that is an overreaction to a tiny bit of pollen. And if you can just put your mindfulness up your nose and just relax that area, it does actually help quite considerably. So that's one way of dealing with pain. With your mindfulness inside. Someone once taught me this method, which is very helpful. Because the pain which you have in the body, it's confined to a certain area of the body. It's very rare that your whole body, I mean really your whole body is aching. It's usually a small area of the body causes this, you know, very hard to endure pain. So you can imagine drawing a box around that pain. Inside is the pain, outside is the rest of your body, which is pretty okay. And once you've drawn a box around the pain, then using your imagination, you expand that box. And as you're expanding the box, you're expanding the pain. But instead of making the pain worse, it's like diluting the pain. And expand it to twice the size, twice the width, twice the depth, twice the height. And doing that little imagination actually does help relax the pain because it expands. Contracting creates more pain. Expansion tends to lessen pain. So that's another little imaginary exercise to do which can sometimes help alleviate much of the pain. And if that doesn't work, then the old simile in opening the door of your heart, which is from the Udana, of the monster who came into the emperor's palace. The monster came into the emperor's palace and sat in the emperor's chair and everyone said, "Get out of there, you don't belong, who do you think you are?" And the demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And of course, how do you get rid of that demon? Not with anger. The emperor came back and said, "Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming to visit me. Please, can I get you something to eat?" So they were kind to the monster. And every act of kindness to a monster makes it an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. So the problem got less and less when they gave kindness to it. Until one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. That's in opening the door of your heart. And that's a wonderful teaching of the Buddha, because he called that an anger-eating demon. It feeds on anger and ill will. The more anger and ill will you give it, the worse it gets. And pain is a classic example of an anger-eating demon. You have pain in your body. Get out of here, you don't belong. And it gets worse. So being kind to that pain. Welcome. How can I look after you? It gets less. Every act of kindness, every moment of opening the door of your heart to that pain, unconditionally, relaxes and the pain gets less and less and less. So the last resort use the method of the demon who came into the emperor's palace. So, that is the last question. So finished in time today. By the end of this retreat, as you become more still, we'll get huge numbers of questions. So I'm glad we can finish early today. But are there any questions from the floor anyone would like to ask about the meditation? If not, we can finish off now. And for those of you who have energy, you can just carry on meditating. For those of you who feel a tiny bit sleepy tonight, give in, have a good night's sleep tonight. Because it's still the first day, we're still getting into this. You don't expect to get enlightened today. If you get enlightened or get jhana today, what are you going to do for the rest of the retreat? You'd be bored. So just take it easy. And just have a nice evening. When you wake up in the morning, it doesn't matter what time you wake up, if you feel got good energy, come and meditate. So that's why we don't have any bells to wake you up. You just wake up when you need to wake up. And have a nice night. See you in the morning.